welcome to Ask an Atheist with Sam Mulvey. Sam's off this week, but you got me, Becky Friedman. And for the first time in a very long time, Dan, how are you?
I am well. It's nice to be back, Becky.
It is really nice to have you back. And rounding out the Dan sandwich, I guess, we have Rebecca Vitzman.
Thank you for having me.
So
redacted.
It's also been a while since you've been on.
Yes, it's been a while.
How's life been treating you?
Oh, so much better.
Okay. And how's life been treating you, Dan?
Pretty good.
Really? Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I'm just about to ruin your day.
Oh, crap.
I know, right? Because Donald Trump stated in an interview with the Associated Press that our air is now cleaner than it's ever been. And he asserted that climate change happens in cycles. And he falsely suggested that nobody really knows whether climate change is an acute problem. He also cited having an uncle who was a professor at MIT as support for his own supposed natural instinct for science. When faced with an intergovernmental panel on climate change report warning that the Earth is nearing a point where climate change effects cannot be reversed without drastic intervention, Trump told Leslie Stahl that the scientists had a big political agenda. Now, here on Ask an Atheist, we are not just atheists who lack a belief in God or gods, but we also are grounded in things like, oh, I don't know, science. And last I checked, the air is not super clean. I mean, one might actually...
Did you check your gut?
I do have kind of a natural instinct for, I don't know, having asthma attacks when particulate matter gets above a certain threshold. Dan, please help me make sense of this one.
Boy, I wish I could. Some of this stuff is technically correct, but most of it is not even wrong.
Like, it's so off that like you can't even say it's wrong?
Right. If you ask me what color the sky is, and I say yellow, I'm wrong.
Okay.
If you ask me what color the sky is, and I say penguins, I am not even wrong. not only am I not correct, I don't even know what you're talking about. And that's pretty much what Donald Trump is every time there is a scientific question. He's not even in the same realm. He did say one thing here that is notably factual. He did, in fact, have an uncle who was a professor at MIT. John Trump was an accomplished scientist, did a lot of research with X-rays, with high voltage machineries. He was a friend of the inventor of the high voltage generators that are now used everywhere, often mistakenly called Tesla coils, but they are, in fact, Van de Graaff generators, which is a totally different piece of machinery. Anyhow.
But his MIT professor uncle didn't actually do work in climate change or
no, he did
earth
not.
Science.
Well,
no,
I have an uncle who's a lawyer, and I have an uncle who works in the oil field, and I have lots of uncles who do lots of things, and in no way does that qualify me for any of their positions whatsoever.
And that's where I'm going with this. Yeah, the ability to understand science is not something that you have a natural instinct for. In fact, getting into a scientific education involves unlearning a tremendous amount of your own instincts and starting to recognize things like personal bias and starting to value objective things like mathematics that are certainly not instinctive. I'm not a psychology major, but I'm pretty sure that any psychology major starting from college freshman to multiple PhD could speak at tremendous length on why science is not something that you have a natural instinct for. And furthermore, a natural instinct for science, if it could exist, is not likely to be a distinctly heritable trait that you're going to pick up from your uncle, a la James Bond Jr. style.
But he could fancy himself James Bond Jr. Don't you think that that's rather Trumpian?
So we got into a lot of this whenever I was working on the disaster project that I was working on. And a lot of what we ended up teaching as part of our trainings were all of the different aspects that were not intuitive at all, that a lot of people have a lot of instincts to, oh, we're going to go do this and we're going to do that and we're going to do this and we have to do it that way. And they do everything wrong. They, you know, there was scientific evidence showing that their impact was having a very negative effect on what they were doing. And so these people with their quote unquote natural instincts often go in and make the situation much worse than what's there. And it's not an intuitive process. It's not just you can stare at it and say, well, I know what I'm doing here. It's a situation that you have no background in whatsoever. And so
I have a little bit of something to relate to this. You know, last weekend, I really enjoyed participating in both California Free Thought Day, which was a big, awesome rally. I know that we had David Diskin, one of the organizers, on a few weeks ago talking about it. But the day before, we had a leadership workshop day for leaders within the secular movement to sort of network and do brain dumps and share our learned wisdom rather than what those natural instincts might be. And all the same, at the same time, grounding it all in data and science. And as you said, undoing some of those things that we find to be intuition. And one of the things that came up with me as a language acquisition teacher and someone with a background in linguistics, you know, you get a lot of people that have quote, a natural understanding of how languages are learned or how new languages are acquired. And it leads to things that things like parents deciding we've just immigrated to the United States. I'm not going to speak our, you know, our former language with my kids because it will interfere with them learning English. And that might be something that is perpetuated throughout generations. Yet science and research has found that there is no detrimental effect, and there is actually long-term a benefit, a positive effect for children who are fluent in multiple languages and are really raised bilingually. So I think in all of these areas of expertise, we find that there's things that we assume as humans to be true or as sort of essential truths, but when we look at those outcomes and when we look at it in a research perspective, we find, wow, you know, the thing that we thought was true isn't really the case.
Well, and I'm pretty sure that anyone with a natural instinct for science would have a natural instinct to trust experts.
Okay. So let's ground it back in this climate change stuff that Trump has been, you know, naturally talking about.
Sure. So I want to point out one of the places where he was technically correct. He asserted that climate change happens in cycles. Well, this is true. With the precession of the Earth, with small changes in our orbit, with changes in atmospheric gas concentrations, volcanic activity, that kind of thing, climate change does appear to happen in cycles throughout the fossil record.
Throughout what?
The fossil record.
How many years are we talking about when we say the fossil record? Are we talking about like the 50s versus the 70s versus now?
Now, on this planet, we're talking about 4.56 billion years.
Oh, okay. So that's really different.
And there are big fluctuations over tens of millions of years. The last time that our CO2 concentration was about this high, it took about 10 million years to get from where it was in 1800 to this concentration. So this most recent one, this most recent quote unquote cycle, if you will, has happened in 200 years versus 10 to 20 million years. And that definitely tells us that this is not part of the natural cycle. It is a huge outlier from the way that things have gone previously. And the by far most logical conclusion is that the unprecedented amounts of fossil fuels being burned and the CO2 and methane that are being released into our atmosphere are the cause. And as far as climate scientists, meteorologists, environmental scientists, there's no debate here. When they say, you know, oh, 99% of scientists agree that climate change is anthropogenic, is being caused by humans and is being caused by the burning of fossil fuels, they are talking about, you know, 99% of scientists. That other 1% are not climate scientists, are not people who specialize in understanding things like the greenhouse gas. They're people who are mathematicians. They're people who are working in other fields of science. If we were going to talk about climate scientists that think that climate change is not being caused by humans, you're looking at 0.00001%, which with the number of climate scientists in the world turns out to be like 15 people.
Well, you know, and there's one other thing that I think that he didn't get wrong, which was that scientists have a big political agenda, which is to change the laws to reflect the science. Like,
we did have a March for Science that looked for scientific integrity in public policy. And if that's a big agenda that you really are fighting against, if that's the extent of your big agenda, I think you're one of the baddies, as we say.
And as far as climate environmental scientists or environmental educators with a background in science like myself, as far as our big political agenda goes, we have one, and it's big, and it's political, and that big political agenda is the preservation of life on Earth, including the human species. period.
That seems like a big agenda. Yeah.
It's really remarkable when you say that, you know, when you look at it and evaluate that Trump is not from a religious perspective, but just from an economic perspective, being so short-sighted in eschewing, you know, rational evidence-based data that's in front of him, that's facing him. And it seems like it's not just short-sighted, but you know, incredibly malicious when I look at it. And that gets into not just a rational or evidence-based, preference of mine, but a secular humanistic preference. You know, when we say this is where my morals are aligned, you know, I may not have a religion, but my secular humanism is something that points me towards being not malicious, being long-sighted, and not thumbing your nose at things that are real and in front of you. And then certainly not saying outright lies like our air is cleaner now than it's ever been. Dan, is our air cleaner now than it's ever been? I mean, what's going on here? I had asthma attacks this summer.
Absolutely.
From our wildfires.
So with the exclusion of wildfires, our air, as far as particulate matter goes, is actually cleaner than it was in the late 70s, early 80s, since all of the Clean Air Acts had gone into effect, the same Clean Air Acts that Trump's trying to reverse. Anyway, as far as particulate matter, soot, stuff like that, our air is actually cleaner, except for the wildfires, which are making a tremendous difference in that. And wildfires that are understood by ecologists and climate scientists to be a symptom of climate change. However, I could say that the air is typically cleaner of particulate matter, but clear and clean are not exactly the same thing. When we're looking at the concentrations of greenhouse gases in the air, you can't see them, but they're there. They're detectable and in much, much higher levels than even 30 years ago.
And so I was also reading recently that as the polar ice caps melt, more methane gas is being released into the atmosphere that has a drastic effect on the warming of the planet.
Yes, methane is about 86 times more potent as a greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide is.
Well, we do have some feedback from listener Matthew from Colorado. And on this whole topic of Trump saying that he has his natural instinct for science, Matthew writes, "Trump's a demagogue, a figurehead, an outlet for all the crazy in this country. Take him away and they'll find another and then another. Stop fighting the symptoms, Trump, and fight the disease, his supporters." What do you guys make of this from a science perspective, a humanist perspective, an atheist perspective? Should we be fighting Trump's supporters?
I do think that that Matthew is correct, that if it wasn't Trump, it would be someone else, and that there isn't an end to people with kind of ridiculous opinions in the historical record. I mean, when was the last time in human history that we didn't have some moron out there making ridiculous claims that we were fighting against? But, you know, we continue that fight, and it's important to continue that fight. And yeah, I do think that fighting against the supporters is where you make the traction.
I come at this from a biological perspective. It's suggested we should fight the disease rather than the symptoms. And I would say that any medical practitioner would tell you to do both. If a child has measles and is experiencing a very high fever, you treat the symptom, which is the fever, so that their brain is not damaged by excessive heat, and you treat the disease. You do both, and it is possible to carry on fights on multiple fronts simultaneously. You don't have to choose one or the other.
So in some of these kinds of respects, we have these political agendas and we have these political strategies as individuals who are invested in things like environmental preservation and conservation, in things like separation of church and state, in things like whatever kind of progressive or different kind of policies that we might be rooting for. But at the same time, it seems like calling something a political agenda is automatically a slam. What do you guys think of the position that just because you have a political agenda doesn't necessarily mean that it's something bad or negative?
To have change at all, you have to have a political agenda. To make change on fundamental levels, you have to have a political agenda. The way that we grow as a country and as a society is through a political agenda. I think this is a fear tactic that is used often by people just saying, oh,
who have their own political agenda.
Who have a political agenda.
Personally, I would look out at the state of the world and I see tremendous problems, social problems, ecological problems. Name a direction and there is a problem. Those problems, as far as a society, get solved through political movements. So I would question anybody who does not have a political agenda. That's far scarier to me.
Or is claiming not to.
Well, as we have our political theme song, I also want to encourage us to be aware that our elections are coming up in the first week of November. And you can go to myvote.org to see that you are properly registered. I know that in Washington State, we've got until October 29th to register in person.
I've already voted. Yay.
This is Ask an Atheist. We'll be back after the break.
If you or a loved one have used any squid ink products, then you may be entitled to
addiction to the products,
growing squid arms,
going mentally insane,
losing friends and or family,
and certain death.
If you have been approached by and or seen members of the Squid Ink Corporation, please contact your local Inkerton Detective Agency immediately.
And welcome back to Ask an Atheist with Sam Mulvey. It's still me, Becky Friedman, in the studio this week with my name counterpart, Rebecca Vitzman.
Hello.
And Dan still in the studio with us. How are you still, Dan?
I'm doing great.
Doing okay still. And I'm really excited for the interview that we've got here because it's some really neat ideas that sometimes we don't hear of very often within the atheist and secular and free thought and humanist movements. But with us today, we've got Luciano Gonzalez. He's a Puerto Rican humanist who's deeply involved in Latin American humanist activism. He is a conflict worker and writer living in Washington, D.C., and he joins us today via Skype to tell us about the exciting new initiative announced by the American Humanist Association, and that is the Latinx Humanist Alliance, which he co-chairs with Dr. Juhem Navarro Rivera. Welcome to the show.
I'm so happy to be here. I'm excited to be able to talk to folks all about the new group and just to tell people about the fact that there are also older groups that have existed and have been doing very, very important work.
Really neat. So to start us out, we're used to hearing the term Latino or Latina, but this is Latinx. Looks like the old language Latin, but with an X on the end. Can you explain that for some of us?
Sure. So this idea is not exactly the most well-received in the Latino, Latina, Latinx community. But what it is it's effectively a gender-neutral signifier, both for groups of Hispanic, Latin American folks, as well as for people who defy the gender binary. And it's been popularized in the United States, but it has been used in Latin America as well. And it is something that's very handy for people who are trans, they're gender non-conforming, or for people who realize that language is alive and language is changing.
Really kind of neat introduction into that kind of world right off the bat.
And then just a moment ago, you were speaking about other groups that were around that you wanted to speak of quickly before we get into Latinx.
Sure. So there are a number of different groups in the United States specifically, but the big ones that people think of when they think of the Hispanic and the Latin American humanist communities are the Secular Latino Alliance, which is a digital Facebook group and just sort of digital meeting place for people who are secular from Latin America and of Latin American descent, who want to meet other people. And then there's also the Hispanic American Freethinkers, which is a national nonprofit and the first of its kind for Latin American freethinkers that is based in D.C. but operates all over the country. And I'm involved with both of those groups in addition to co-chairing the Latinx Humanist Alliance.
That sounds really cool. Some folks may wonder why Latino or Hispanic folks need a separate organization. They might, you know, perhaps think that we're all human, so shouldn't humanism just be enough? How do you respond to that?
I think that this is a reasonable concern that comes from a good place, but I also think that it ignores the reality that people who are of Latin American descent and people from Latin America come from a different culture. And the idea that we share one monolithic culture is a very dangerous idea, and it's one that I strongly dislike. But all of Latin America is very deeply religious. And it's nice for Latin Americans in the United States who are secular humanists, who are free thinkers, who are non-believers, to have places online and offline where they can go and they can meet other people who have the same experiences, whether it's talking about Three Kings Day or talking about the evil eye. Like, there are certain things that it makes us feel more comfortable to be able to talk about with people who can relate to them. And that's part of the purpose of these groups.
You got to back up a second. I consider myself somewhat well-versed in many different Latin American cultures, being someone who is bilingual and has lived abroad. But evil eye, you have to back that one up, because I'm familiar with that in sort of a Middle Eastern context. But what is the evil eye in a Latin American context?
So the evil eye in a Latin American context is a very funny cultural thing. It's effectively the idea that there is some witchcraft that's so powerful that someone can look at someone else and that can be enough to cause them to be cursed. And it's a very quirky idea. I know that there are variations of it that pop up all over the world, but it's something that I hear a lot as a Latin American. And I was raised in Latin America myself. I was raised in Colombia, Honduras, and Panama, and I had encounters with people who believed this sincerely and who, like, wanted to fight against it, to the point where even in the United States, there are brujeria shops that are popping up all over the place where you can go and you can get blessings to protect you against the evil eye.
Wow. So this is something that may not be within the purview or the experience of humanists or atheists that do not have that shared heritage. I can definitely see why there might be some call for specific organizations for that.
So speaking of specific organizations, you said that there were some organizations that were already doing similar things. How did you get this idea off the ground?
Sure. So the main people who actually helped set up the groundwork for this organization were Dr. Juem Navarro-Rivera and the people over at the AHA. I came in at a later stage, but I was one of the people who helped sit down and write out some of the stuff that we wanted to do, like the Secular Speakers Bureau, which is already a thing that exists in other groups. But one of the main things that we're going to be doing that separates it is we're going to be getting people who speak English and Spanish, or one or the other, and we're going to be putting them on a list. So that way, if there are other free thinkers or humanists who are looking for speakers who can bring uncommon perspectives in humanistic spaces and free thinking spaces, they can go over to us and they can look at our list and they can hire people from Latin America and of Latin American descent. This is something that's really important, because as much as I've looked, there are a few Hispanic people on lists like these, but there aren't that many. And usually when there's people who are on these lists, it's always the same people. It's David Tamayo, the president of HAFRI. It is Eva Quiñones, the president of the Humanistas Seculares de Puerto Rico. It's Shirley Rivera, and it's in some cases people like Fernando Alicantar. And Shirley is the president of the Atheistas de Puerto Rico, and Fernando is an author who lives in the United States and is of Mexican. He's a Mexican immigrant.
So I hear a lot of this Puerto Rico presence. How do you plan to address concerns and perspectives and interests of diverse Latinx people when, you know, given that you and Dr. Navarro are both of Puerto Rican background?
Sure. So we aren't the only people who are in the group. We have people from Mexico and we have people from Colombia in the group as well, but we're also actively expanding, and we are both reaching out to people and we are getting responses from people from other parts of the world. But in addition to this, there's also people like me, where it's safe to say that I am Puerto Rican. That is accurate. But I was also raised in Honduras, Panama, and Colombia. So to say that just because we were born in one place, or we have parents from one place, that we don't fully understand the complexity of our community is a little bit unfair, even if it makes sense, especially when there are people like me who were raised in other places. And also, as I mentioned before, we're definitely looking out for more people from different communities, and we're always really excited whenever someone from a community that doesn't have representation reaches out to us. So I'm hoping that more people will start to get involved.
That sounds awesome. I am excited to see it take off. I was wondering, is this Speakers Bureau geared for the free thought community itself, or are you guys going to be reaching out to a wider audience as well?
We are definitely interested in reaching out to a wider audience. We have plans to do that. It's just that right now we want the list to be humanists and to be free thinkers, and we want to get more involved with the humanistic and free thought communities. And that's because a lot of us are able to go and speak at other places, and we have experience speaking at other places, but for some reason it's a little bit more challenging. We have a bit of a harder time breaking into and speaking at humanistic conferences.
So outside of the Speakers Bureau, there are two other projects going. What are they? Can you tell us a little about them?
Yeah, so one of the other projects that we're working on is the creation of a media kit. And what we want to do with that is we want to create resources for people from our communities, and also for journalists looking for people from our communities. So that way we can gain more accurate media coverage, and that way we can be more involved when it comes to media that's seeking to explore the diversity of religion and religiosity in Latin America and in Latin American spaces in the United States. And then the other one is that we are also working on submitting resolutions for the AHA. And these resolutions are going to cover a wide range of topics. Some of the ones could be things like education, could be things like immigration and environmentalism, all of which are key issues for Latinx voters and also for Latinx people in general.
You know, you referred to or alluded to the huge diversity within the Latino community in the United States. You know, it is hugely diverse to the point sometimes where labels like Hispanic or Latino aren't even very useful. How does diversity within the non-religious Latino or Latin American community manifest?
Sure. So I think that for me personally, one of the biggest ways that this diversity manifests itself is in people talking about issues related to sex and sexuality. I myself am an asexual person, and like the way that I talk about relationships and the way that I relate to other people is definitely affected by that. And I think it's interesting because I wasn't safe and I wasn't free to explore that back when I was a theist. And now that I'm a non-theist, I have a lot more freedom in that area. Another big thing is when we talk about like our own cultures and we talk about our own experiences as immigrants and as the children of immigrants, we have widely different opinions and there are widely different experiences there, because I myself am Puerto Rican, and that means that I was a citizen at birth. But I have friends who are Honduran, who are in the free thinking community, and they are immigrants. They are both documented and undocumented immigrants, and that wildly affects their experiences in the United States and even within their own community.
So I personally, this is Rebecca Witzman, I am labeled as Hispanic. My grandmother's first language was Spanish. But whenever I hear of Latinx and I hear of the different speakers involved, I always like count myself out, kind of. I step back and I'm just like, well, that's for people who are directly immigrants, or, you know, even though my upbringing was Spanish Catholic, and even though, you know, I have all these different experiences that come with that upbringing, that for some reason, up until this very moment while you're speaking, I have just not included myself in this group. So what would you say to people who were like me, who are, you know, thinking of themselves as not who you're speaking to with this organization?
I think it's perfectly understandable for people to hear about this organization and for them to experience a disconnect, even if they are biologically, not, that's not the right word, but even if they have heritages that are Hispanic, Latin American, Latinx, Latino, Latina, all of that, I think that makes a lot of sense. And I know that when I was born and I was raised, the first 5 years of my life, I lived in the United States. And I definitely didn't identify as Hispanic when that was happening with me. It took me a longer time for me to realize what it really meant to be Hispanic. And I'm lucky because I am either white passing or white, depending on who you ask. So for me, people don't look at me and think that I am Hispanic. But then when they hear me talk about Latin America, they realize that I am. And it's a choice that I make. And I realize that other people aren't going to make the same choices. But for me, I want to help what I feel like is part of my community. And I want my community to grow. So if I'm talking to people who have experiences and perceptions similar to yours, I'm hoping that I can get them interested in reconnecting with that part of their heritage and their familial inheritance.
So in Humanist magazine, you stated that the conversations that take place throughout the United States revolving around humanism lack a Latinx perspective. Why do you think that's been the case? What's the relationship between LHA and the American Humanist Association like?
Sure. So the relationship between the LHA and the American Humanist Association is that the LHA is an affiliate group and one of the advisory groups to the AHA. And we help them have better conversations, or we will, because we're a fairly new group. We will be helping them have better conversations when it comes to topics that are relevant to Hispanic, Latin American readers and AHA members. And I think that the main reason why it's been so difficult for conversations from humanistic points of views to have perceptions and perspectives that are Hispanic and Latin American is because for so long, not only have Latin American and Hispanic humanists been a minority, there have also been difficulties when it comes to getting us to organize. The oldest group of the three groups that I talked about earlier is the Hispanic American Freethinkers, and it's only been around since 2010. And conversations from humanistic perspectives have been going on a lot longer than that. So it makes sense that there's been a difficulty. And I'm hoping that between all of the groups in the United States, and there's more than just those three, but I'm hoping that between all of us, we can have better conversations going forward. And we can learn from the perspectives of organizers who've been involved in this sort of work for years.
The social media pages for this new group allude to immigration issues like immigration or unpacking Hispanic heritage, as Becca sort of touched upon, or LGBTQ plus issues, as you touched upon. How do you see these things intersecting with secular humanism?
I think that part of what it's going to take is that there needs to be a separation of church and state in the conversations that all of these topics have. And I think that's a very important first step, but it's far from the only way that these things intersect. Additionally, I can speak to my own experiences as someone who is LGBT plus. There is a definite need, both in Latin America and in the United States, for there to be a decoupling of religion and sexuality. And I think that groups like the AHA and the LHA getting more involved in these conversations will definitely go and push things in a better direction moving forward.
You know, we've seen so many people that are disaffiliated from religion. We've seen that population growing. That segment of the United States, you know, demographics has been growing, but not necessarily folks that align themselves with atheism or humanism. Do you think that the Latinx Humanist Alliance can provide some grounding for those folks that maybe are seekers or who have left their natal religions and are kind of wandering around?
I absolutely think that can be the case. And I know that in Latin America and in Latin American spaces in the United States, it's difficult for someone to say that they are a non-believer, even to themselves. I had difficulties with that when I first realized that I had at some point stopped being a believer. And I'm hoping that the LHA can provide a reasonable basis for people to feel more comfortable, if not calling themselves atheists or agnostics, at the very least calling themselves and truly identifying as humanists.
That's really cool. Sometimes when we leave structures that have a lot of hierarchical leadership, positions and things like that, we get very cautious and tentative about other kinds of organized activities. What's the leadership structure like in Latinx Humanist Alliance?
So in the Latinx Humanist Alliance, there are the co-chairs and then there's the leadership board. And all of us fulfill very important roles. We all contribute important resources and important time. It's just that the co-chairs were the people who said that this is an organization that we very firmly believe in and that we're willing to put in the time and the energy needed to push it in the direction that it needs to go. So that way it's not just a place where people can go and like it on Facebook or follow it on Twitter and get news. but actually a community that people can see and that people can become a part of that contributes things to humanism and to the conversations that Latinx folks are having about religion, humanism, and irreligion.
So you mentioned Facebook and Twitter. How can listeners get in touch with you or learn a little bit more about the Latinx Humanist Alliance?
Sure. So if you follow us, if you like us on Facebook, or if you follow us on Twitter, you'll get updates. And so far, a lot of those updates are just things like posts that we've written. But in the next couple of weeks, as we start to develop our website more, and as we start to gain new membership, our website's going to grow. People are going to start getting newsletters, and they're going to start getting action alerts. And those are fantastic things that they can see that will enable them to keep up to date with the most recent and most breaking news that's going on about immigration, that's going on about LGBT issues, that's going on about environmentalism, as well as important pieces that talk about Latinx culture and Latinx identity.
So what is the website for the Latinx Humanist Alliance?
It is Latinx Humanists, and I will definitely be placing it all over the place online. I've already done that a lot. So if anyone needs help connecting with it, they can either go to the AHA's website. They will hopefully be able to find a little link to it somewhere over here. But it is, I'm going to type it in just to be 100% sure, but it is latinxhumanists.org.
Nice. Excellent. And you yourself are an accomplished blogger. You can definitely give a shout out to where we can find some of your writings.
Oh, absolutely. So I have a Patheos blog. It is called Sin God, and I talk about all sorts of things. Lately, because I am a graduate student studying peace and conflict studies, most of my writing has related in some way to peace and conflict studies. But you can go over to my blog and you'll be able to find all sorts of things from news about atheism in Latin America to separation of church state issues in places like Colombia and Honduras. And you can also just find opinion pieces about some of the most recent Latinx media like La Llorona or Jane the Virgin or One Day at a Time.
That's awesome. Luciano Gonzalez is a Puerto Rican humanist. He's deeply involved in Latin American humanist activism. And he was joining us today to talk about the Latinx Humanist Alliance. Thank you so much for joining us, Luciano.
Thank you so much for having me. I hope I can come back sometime.
You've been listening to Ask an Atheist with Sam Mulvey, and we'll be back after the break with a little bit more news and maybe some fun stuff, maybe some heavy stuff. We'll see you in a bit.
Hello. We are here to inform you about the dangers of squid ink. My name is Lila. I am here with Bree and Ash. Squid ink does not do anything good. It hurts people. It's dangerous. Now on to Ash to tell you what squid ink is supposed to do, but it doesn't, and what it shouldn't do that it does.
Yes, thank you, Lila. Now, squid ink side effects are very dangerous. The scar healer is supposed to get rid of the cuts. No, it causes explosive diarrhea. If hold it on for too long, you could explode. Now, on to Brianna.
Thank you, Ash. You see, squid ink can cause severe bleeding, coughing, sudden paralysis, and death. You now know this. You cannot ignore this. Now, on to Lila.
Thank you, Bree. Thank you, Ash. As you see, squid ink is not safe. It's dangerous. Listen, or you will be in danger. If you want to be rid of squid ink forever, call 1-800-SQUID-INK right now.
Yeet! Hello and welcome back to Ask an Atheist. You can give us a call anytime at 844-SKEPTIC or tweet us at AskAnAtheistWA. We love social media and voicemails and emails. Man, I got one more really fun, nice thing in the world of atheism and humanism. And that is that a foundation dedicated to advancing humanist values and ensuring reason-based public policy has pledged to support the American Humanist Association in research related to public opinion of non-theists. For every new elected official who identifies as a humanist, atheist, or non-theist at the federal and state level, the Stiefel Freethought Foundation will give $1,000 up to $25,000 in total. Todd Stiefel, who has given over $5 million to various freethought and educational causes, said that he wanted to encourage humanist values in elected leaders in this time of divisiveness and bigotry.
Yay. Thank you, Todd.
I love it, especially coming off of California Freethought Day when we have folks that are in Congress that have started the Congressional Freethought Caucus. I think it's really cool. One of the things I question, though, is does that elected official need to actually identify as non-religious or humanist? Or can they just be an ally that is dedicated to the position of separation of church and state? I don't know. What do you guys think?
Personally, I'm happy to have anybody in office who is friendly to the ideas that facts are real and that science on many political agenda topics is, in fact, well understood and studied. So I wouldn't have to require that somebody be specifically a humanist or an atheist. I would just be happy to have somebody in there who believes in science.
You speak of the devil. You please him, Dan. Wait, I might be channeling.
That's every other Sunday.
I might be channeling someone. Latter-day Saints leader Dallin Oaks, who urged that practitioners of his faith, commonly known as Mormons, must exercise caution with regards to secular and scientific thinking, saying that science should not be relied upon for making personal decisions since it is not, as he says, the whole of life. His pronouncements were heard at this year's semi-annual general conference in Utah. Oaks also urged attendees to oppose abortion, euthanasia, and any legal or social pressures away from what he described as traditional marriage, and cautioned his audience against heeding anonymous online information. Oaks, whose official title is First Counselor in the Governing First Presidency of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, also hewed the command of President Russell M. Nelson to avoid shorthand names for the faith, like Mormon or LDS, since, according to the 94-year-old Nelson, doing so is a, quote, major victory for Satan.
Oh, also, it should major? Be noted that he doesn't want them to even say Latter-day Saints, because leaving out Jesus Christ is also a victory for Satan. It must be the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, all of it.
It sounds more and more like robot speak.
they should do that would make it better, I think.
I just want to know, like, this is a major victory for Satan. This is a major victory to say LDS or Mormons or
no shorthand
Latter-day Saints. Like,
a minor victory is if, you know, I get to marry a girl or something like that, you know, yeah, a woman. Yeah. That would be a minor victory. But if I mislabel the faith, then it's a major victory. I just want
to hear from them.
He's 94. You know. And I don't know if I've met many 94-year-old people. In my life, this is ageist. I just realized this is ageist. I was just thinking of everybody plus 90 plus that I've ever met who was like, no, you need to say the entirety of the thing, where I would say, yeah, I'm going to listen to this person. But unfortunately, because of his placement inside of this religion,
his status,
he
right?
is basically considered and revered as a prophet. And he is speaking from the Lord, their God.
So does this make it any different from individuals who say, you know what, the word Latino or Hispanic doesn't define me. I want to be identified with an X as Latinx, or I want to have my honorific be neither Mr. nor Ms. nor Mrs., but MX. I mean, I tend to support, I'll call you what you want to be called because you get to self-define. Is there a difference between what Mr. Nelson is doing?
I don't think there is. I honestly believe that moving forward, I am probably going to say Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. I will probably say it like that. But I do think that they have the right to define themselves as they choose. And if what they want to do is listen to a 94-year-old guy who they revere as a prophet who says this is the way that they must identify themselves, then I'm gonna do it. That's just my personal.
I'm going to be the jerk here. Sure. Call people what they ask you to call them. I'm totally okay with that.
That doesn't seem so jerky.
No. Well, here's the jerk part. Just from a logical perspective, if I were 94 years old, I'd probably shorthand a lot of things because the clock is ticking.
Oh, dear. Well, you know, the practitioners of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Did I get it right? I think I did. They're not the only ones that are concerned about victories for the devil. Pope Francis is asking his faithful to pray every day in October for God to protect the Roman Catholic Church from Satan, who the pontiff says is responsible for church divisions and sexual abuse scandals worldwide. Francis used the moniker Great Accuser to refer to the devil, but some criticize the phrasing as a thinly veiled attack on Archbishop Carlo Maria Vigano, who is former Vatican ambassador to the U.S. Vigano produced a report this past August criticizing U.S. church officials and the Pope himself for their oversight of a sex scandal involving a former cardinal and young seminarians. The prayer that Francis proposed is one from pre-Vatican II tradition that petitions the Archangel Michael, St. Michael, to defend Catholics from battle against Satan.
I just get visceral over this kind of stuff. Whenever you start pointing at Satan because of the things that are going wrong, especially whenever somebody is, you know, looking for accountability, looking for how you can change yourself so that this kind of stuff does not, you know, continue to proliferate throughout your entire religion, It just makes me viscerally angry. It's just, no, take accountability. Don't point at the devil and say, oh, the devil made him do it.
For me, this is just sort of one more nail in the coffin when people talk about, oh, the new Pope, and he's so progressive, and he's so different. No.
He's literally digging up stuff from pre-John Paul II, right? Like, he's bringing up pre-Vatican II, which is a time when, you know, you didn't have services in your own language. You had Latin Mass. You had the priests that didn't face the congregation. I think that there's something really symbolic, literally, about facing the congregation. If the Pope were really going to face his faithful, his congregation, his worldwide congregation of those who were raised Catholic or are still observantly Catholic, who have been harmed tremendously by sex abuse within the church, either because of imbalance of power, which is the case with these young seminarians, you know, you had older priests that were supposed to be role models that would coerce, you know, young, 18, 19, 20 year old men into sexual encounters, or children who were harmed without recompense, without any kind of accountability. When the Pope harkens back to a time when he didn't face his congregation in order to say, this is what's going to heal us, this is what's going to protect us, I find that despicable. I guess you guys too. I've left you speechless.
We're right there with you. Yeah.
Well, you know what? It's not just this ostensibly progressive Pope that is actually, when you look behind the curtain, having a lot of these really regressive things. We go to Michigan, where it's just become known that a pharmacist at the Mayer grocery and pharmacy chain, he's under fire after a woman recently spoke out about her experience being denied medication during a miscarriage because of the pharmacist's religious beliefs, and he happened to be Catholic. Rachel Peterson was prescribed misoprostol this summer to aid in the completion of her miscarried pregnancy, but the pharmacist on duty refused to fill it or have another staff member take the order or even transfer the request to another pharmacy because of his beliefs as a Catholic. The drug has a number of uses, including stomach ulcer prevention, treatment of postpartum hemorrhage, and labor induction. It can also be used to chemically induce abortion when used in combination with a second drug. The ACLU asserts that the pharmacist did indeed violate anti-discrimination public accommodation laws because he likely would have filled the request had Rachel been a man being treated for stomach ulcers.
You know, whenever I read this, I immediately wondered, how did he get this information that this is used in abortions? I mean, I myself used, you know, I can't pronounce it, misoprostol, for one of my abortions. And so my brain, you know, before ever, you know, being introduced to this drug, why would he have this knowledge that this is used as an abortion medication? I'm assuming that he just kind of has a running knowledge of things that are used in that manner.
I would expect my pharmacist to have an understanding or at least read the label of what its uses are. But we also know that there's a tremendous amount of prescribing for off-label use. And the fact that this particular drug has many uses.
That's what I'm getting at, is because it has so many uses, why would he deny somebody this medication outside of knowing it was used for abortions? And so not allowing this woman to be able to use it. What if she did have a stomach ulcer? What if it was for that? What if she did have some kind of hemorrhaging going on and she was given this prescription? And so
It's not a pharmacist's business to ask why you need this, why you've been prescribed it. The doctor prescribed it. It is something that has been deemed necessary for you.
Exactly. Right. And so what I'm getting at is essentially, like, is somebody contacting these doctors and giving them this list of drugs that they shouldn't be allowed to give out anymore if they have this, like, thing? Or did this guy just go rogue?
What you actually see in very anti-abortion communities is exactly that. These lists of things that, didn't you know that X, Y, and Z are the abortion drugs? The other thing that this is used for, kind of off-label, is it does, it's called ripen the cervix. And ripen seems like a very weird word for it, but it allows for things to pass through the cervix, which is at the, you know, the base of the uterus, more easily. And so when you have, when you have insertion of an IUD, an intrauterine device, for instance, that's a drug that can be prescribed for that because it loosens it a little bit and makes insertion a little bit easier. Well, imagine that someone who is against, any kind of unguided by God procreative intervention, I imagine would also be against the insertion of IUDs or kinds of birth control. And so at least those two uses is enough for this person to say, nope, it's off my prescribing list. Even when you have things like stomach ulcers or the completion of a miscarriage, what really angers me here is it's very dangerous to have an incomplete miscarriage. It can lead to sepsis. It's one of the impetus behind Ireland legalizing and decriminalizing abortion was the death of a woman who had an incomplete miscarriage, became septic, and died. And for someone to say, my personal religion and you as a woman are not allowed to have this prescription is I'm back to despicable.
It's just dangerous.
And I'd like to point out here that there was definitely an option to suggest that another coworker could fill this prescription.
Well, and they could
or
also
to
transfer,
forward it to another pharmacy, and they opted not to do that. And this is where, you know, I am very much pro workers' rights, but this is an exception. If you cannot do the job, you have no business doing the job.
And at this point, when we see these pharmacists that are refusing to do their job, I think that even saying, I'm going to refer you and transfer you to another pharmacy, that's a huge burden. You know, you don't know what it's like for a woman that is undergoing pregnancy loss and to go and stand in line at a grocery store pharmacy and then say, oh, I'm not going to do this because it conflicts with my sincerely held beliefs because I truly believe that this is causing an abortion, when all medical professionals have prescribed it for an incomplete miscarriage. You know, then to burden this woman, your beliefs as a Catholic pharmacist are not unduly burdened by the government. You are unduly burdening this woman who is going through medical difficulty and, I imagine, emotional difficulty. You're burdening her by sending her off to some other pharmacy somewhere else. And who knows? I mean, at least here in Tacoma, we've got a lot of pharmacies within walking distance of each other. But in many parts of the country, you got to drive into town. You've got to take public transportation. This might be the only place that you can fill these kinds of prescriptions. And I think that it's abominable to have this way for people to deny care and deny access to medical treatments, procedures, because of your religion. That has nothing to do with this person executing their own beliefs. And it's, you know, you can say that the Pope is all progressive, but, you know, I'll be progressive and happy and sunshine and flowers if he said, hey, you know what? If you are a Catholic in a secular pluralistic country and you should be held by the laws of that country, right? Render unto Caesar what is his, you know, do your own thing within your own home, but follow the laws of the land. Should we go to a different land?
Let's go to a different land.
All right. This is one more kind of real heavy thing. And this is where, you know, I don't have a quarrel with religious folks that practice in their own ways. It gets to me when we see governmental elevating of religion. And in the same way, it gets to me when I see governmental elevation of atheism, of enforced non-religion. And for all I can tell, this is kind of what's going on in China. China has been launching a campaign critical of halal foods in Xinjiang, the region with the highest concentration of the country's Uyghur Muslim minority, and has legalized what amount to re-education detention camps. Chinese officials admitted to the UN this summer that Uyghur residents were being resettled and subjected to thought transformation. Communist Party leaders in the province's main city recently had to swear an oath to fight a decisive battle against pan-halalization, ostensibly to stop hostility toward religion, that's their words, and Islam's purported penetration into secular life. Canteens at government posts in the region that had offered halal products are headed for diversification, with all government employees ordered to eat diverse cuisine, speak standard Mandarin, and forgo any kind of religious belief. Prayer and beards, headscarves, veils, and avoiding alcohol can be deemed extremist in the westernmost province of China. And Amnesty International reports that up to 1 million members of the Uyghur ethnic minority have been detained for thought transformation re-education.
That's
wow.
Scary.
This is not what I'm hoping for when I look for more acceptance of atheism and folks that don't have religious belief. This is not right. What I'm looking for.
I know that Nathan and Dan would both, they have beards, and so that would get you caught in a re-education program.
So is your beard stylistic or linked to your religious belief, Dan?
My beard is linked to my belief that I do not have a jawline without it, and I look better with one.
You extremist!
That's me.
But, you know, we can joke about all of those things, but at the same time, it's really scary to think that someone in the name of quashing other religious beliefs is subjecting folks to, you know, these detention camps, these thought re-education.
Well, these thought re-education camps do things like, if you won't denounce your religion and, you know, say the government-sponsored things that they want you to say, they'll deny you food. Inside of these detention camps, people are being physically abused. The tactics that they use to, quote unquote, re-educate people are considered inhumane. So it's, you know, the title of re-education sounds so like, oh, they're going to college. No, it's nothing like that.
This is not a scholarship. No, you don't get to live in a nice dorm.
Mentally, physically, emotionally abusive situations that these people are going into, where they have to, you know, state that they don't believe what they believe, even though they believe it, and basically jump through the hoops just to get out.
Well, I think what this is evidence for is that we as atheists, we don't have an atheist agenda where we want to have atheist supremacy in our government. We want to have a pluralistic society where people can have self-agency to name themselves as they wish, to practice as they wish in ways that do not interfere and burden others. And some scary stuff coming from different kinds of countries and governments. But I think that's all the time that we have today. Thank you, Becca.
Yes, thank you for having me.
Thanks, Dan.
Happy to be of service.
We want to thank Luciano as well for joining us and wish him luck with the Latinx Humanist Alliance. You can always get in touch with us at Ask an Atheist by checking out our webpage, atheist.radio. You can tweet us at Ask an Atheist WA. Find us on Facebook with the same place. We'll see you guys next week. Make sure you're registered to vote!